bell. Listen, my sisters and brothers, 'cause if you do, you can hear there are voices still calling across the years. And they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land, and they will too, we all come to understand. None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free. One of us are chained. None of us are free.
Welcome to Arts Express. This is Prairie Miller, and on the show...
You got this love, homie? That's how black people be getting ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Obama.
Change.
He got to be president, so now the rest of us get to be...
in prison.
How's it going, kids?
And I have started to feel unsafe lately.
We're down, we go.
Everybody getting on each other's nerves, we get stirred.
They hate me, I hate them. Our relationship is simple.
Do you know the difference between pain and suffering? Pain is always there. But suffering is a choice.
I'm really tired of walking around like a dog.
Down we go.
And those were scenes from Orange is the New Black, the six-season prison drama that starred, among others, Lorraine Toussaint as V. And Toussaint is on the line to discuss the Sundance Film Festival this month and what her character, the real-life, late flamboyant civil rights activist Flo Kennedy, will be up to in the Sundance premiere of The Glorias, the page-to-screen adapted memoir of women's rights activist Gloria Steinem, My Life on the Road. Toussaint will also touch on related topics of mass incarceration and playing an undocumented immigrant and the voice of God in movies. Plus, the Poetry Corner, the rebellion of female laundry workers of the Washing Society, Bro on the Global Television Beat with What to Watch or Not, and Is America Cursed? James Dean, McCarthyism, and U.S. Imperialism. But first, the Sundance Film Festival and a conversation with actress Lorraine Toussaint, who stars in the premiere there of The Glorias as the late dynamic activist Flo Kennedy in the memoir-based drama sorting out the life journey of women's rights organizer Gloria Steinem, who was portrayed by no less than five actresses, incarnations of herself, including Julianne Moore as the adult Steinem today. The Trinidad-born Toussaint also talks about playing an undocumented immigrant mother in the sports drama Sprinter, what Orange is the New Black and its implications for mass incarceration in the real world have meant to her, and playing, well, the voice of God in Anne Frank Meets God, plus her memorable role in another film recently covered on the show, the World War II meets Jim Crow South drama, Sophie and the Rising Sun. But first, you know, I think I was looking at a conventional life as inevitable or an obligation, and when I discovered that not everybody has to live that same way, it was like a celebration. In this presentation, Gloria Steinem talks about My Life on the Road, her memoir upon which The Glorias is based.
I was in a yellow taxi. I saw a big billboard that was for one of the Dracula television series. And I said to the driver, you know, I think I understand a lot of things about public appeal, but I do not understand vampires. The driver turned out to be from Transylvania. What are the odds? But there it is. childhood taught me to live with uncertainty. Because my father's philosophy was, if you don't know what will happen tomorrow, it could be wonderful. Until I was 10, we were traveling every fall and winter. I went to school until Halloween or whenever it got cold. Then we got in our house trailer, usually on a moment's notice. My father's, would say, okay, it's time to go. And we would end up with 7 frying pans and 2 plates. And we made our living selling antiques along the road to Florida or California. That was just the way it was. I didn't question it. But I was hyper aware that this was a very unconventional home. I did sometimes wish that my real parents would come and rescue me, take me to a house with a horse and a school nearby. The stereotype of the husband driving and the passive woman passenger was absolutely my parents. But I was something else because I was in the back seat, leading a dream life, reading books, looking out the window. I once drove. In high school, I had a license. I've never owned a car. I started this on-the-road book just assuming that the way I travel is natural. And then I realized I have to explain why I don't drive. If you don't drive, the trip, the adventure, begins at your door. You are not by yourself in a tin can. You are immediately in the subway or the bus or in a taxi, which is like a world, a universe. When I was little, I was sure that I would grow up and be like everyone else. I would have a home like in the movies. I kept saying to myself and the world, yes, I'm definitely getting married and having children and settling down, just not right now. And I kept putting it off and off and off and off. I think I was looking at a conventional life as inevitable or an obligation. And when I discovered that, that's a fine life, but not everybody has to live the same way. It was like a celebration. The discovery was that it was possible to have both a home and a journey.
And now here's Lorraine Toussaint talking about the opening of the Glorias at Sundance this month. But first, a scene from Sophie and the Rising Sun, the mid-20th century Jim Crow South drama in which Toussaint stars as a maid, invisible as a human being, so that a childhood friend played by Julia Nicholson neither remembers her or knows her name.
My Queen Sally, how could I not know you?
Well, life has worn some unexpected lines into my face.
I never knew your name was Salome.
Queen Sally took me a ways, but got hard to keep her going. Salome is what's left.
Where did you go?
I traveled around some, all over the South. I was a singer, the big band. Almost made it to Hollywood once.
Oh, my goodness, you. Sophie, you are in a whole lot of trouble.
Good morning, Prairie. How are you?
Okay, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
Great, okay. What can or can't you say about one of the most anticipated upcoming productions, The Glorias, A Life on the Road, based on Gloria Steinem's memoir, and in which you play Flo Kennedy?
Julie Taymor, who's an extraordinary filmmaker, has a very clear vision of how she's of this film, of how she wants to bring Gloria to life. She has five Glorias in this film, and Julianne Moore plays the adult Gloria, and so she is Chloe Kennedy is one of the icons of the feminist movement. She certainly hasn't gotten the credit for it that she deserves, and that was one of the things that Gloria Steinem and Julie Taymor wanted to make sure that she was well represented in this film. She's an outrageous character, wore cowboy hats, and extraordinarily profane and outspoken and brilliant. A Harvard attorney, Chloe Kennedy Chloe Kennedy rocked.
And you have a lot of other films, a lot of projects. What about Sprinter? What can you say about playing an undocumented immigrant struggling to support her family?
I'm an immigrant. I came to this country when I was 10 years old, so that experience is not at all. It's very familiar to me. It's not unfamiliar. And my mother came to this country in the 60s. In that wave of domestics that came over, and if you worked as a domestic for 2 years, you got your green card. So I'm certainly a citizen of the United States, but I still consider myself of immigrant stock. And so it was wonderful doing that film and bringing that to life. Those are many untold stories. That's a wonderful film.
And did you draw from anything growing up in an immigrant family to play that character?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she's a Caribbean immigrant, and I'm very familiar with that experience, yes.
And you've also quite an unusual role recently playing God in the short film Anne Frank Meets God. What intrigued you about getting to play God?
Oh, you know, as my husband says, you know, God is a black woman, and he's an Italian white man, and so he would know. So I love being, I've been doing a lot of voiceover work lately, and that's a very creative in a very different way. And this is an interesting, intimate relationship between God and Anne, and that was a very interesting project. I rather liked it, and I liked the final outcome of it.
And I did want to ask you, Orange is the New Black was your breakout role as Yvonne. What did it mean to you to play in a prison drama, especially in relation to mass incarceration in this country, in particular of people of color?
The privatization of prisons is one of the more horrendous things that has occurred and is still occurring in this country. And as many people have said, prisons have become in many ways the new slave plantations. And so it's important to me that prison reform be really, we should be focusing on true prison reform, because it ain't working. And certainly people of color have been on the receiving end of this injustice. So, having said that, mostly as an artist, I pretty much hold the mirror up to society. That's how I'm most political. And at the end of the day, my job is to entertain and enlighten, hopefully, at the same time. So hopefully I've done that.
And one last question. When Lorraine Toussaint looks in the mirror, what does she see?
I don't know. I see somebody's mom.
Okay.
I see my daughter's mother. I see my mother's face looking back at me. And fortunately, I love my mother's face, and I love being my daughter's mother. And so I am very happy with what's looking back at me.
Great. Okay, well, thank you so much, Lorraine Toussaint, for calling into the show.
I thank you.
And we'll go out now with this segment on Arts Express as Lorraine Toussaint reads her favorite Pablo Neruda poem, If You Forget Me.
When I think of love, I think of Pablo Neruda. He's a favorite of mine, and this is one of my favorite poems. It's called If You Forget Me. I want you to know one thing. You know how this is. If I look at the crystal moon, at the red branch of the slow autumn at my window, if I touch near the fire the implacable ash or the wrinkled body of the log, everything carries me to you, as if everything that exists, aromas, light metals, were little boats that sail toward those isles of yours that wait for me. Well now, if little by little you stop loving me, I shall stop loving you little by little. If suddenly you forgot me, do not look for me, for I shall already have forgotten you. If you think it long and mad, the wind of banners that passes through my life, if you decide to leave me at the shore of the heart where I have roots, remember that on that day, at that hour, I shall lift my arms and my roots will set off to seek another land. But if each day, each hour, you feel that you are destined for me with implacable sweetness, if each day a flower climbs up to your lips to seek me, ah, my love, ah, my own, in me all that fire is repeated. In me nothing is extinguished or forgotten. My love feeds on your love, beloved, and as long as you live, it will be in your arms without leaving mine.
And that was Lorraine Toussaint talking about The Glorias, which premieres at the Sundance Film Festival on January 26th, and My Life on the Road is a New Yorker production. And next up on Arts Express, political analyst, RT reporter, and contributor to the show Caleb Maupin with Is America Cursed? James Dean, McCarthyism, and U.S. Imperialism, referencing John Brown, Harriet Tubman, time machines, the public library, and what the 1950s were really about.
The world is constantly in motion, contradictions driving forward history. You know, I've only been out to L.A. one other time. I was here like 10 years ago to help build a Stop War Against Iran demonstration a long time ago. But, I never really had a chance to do any tourism when I was out there. So this time when I was out here, I decided I wanted to visit a place called Griffith Observatory. And, you know, it's a beautiful place out here in L.A., and it's in one of my favorite movies, and that movie is not La La Land. And it's in one of my favorite movies, an old movie, a 1955 film called Rebel Without a Cause. Has anyone here ever seen Rebel Without a Cause? Classic movie. James Dean, Natalie Wood, Sal Mineo. 1955 movie about juvenile delinquents. The 1950s, the USA has a booming economy, but they couldn't figure out why there was such a rise in juvenile crime. And it wasn't crime against, you know, low-income kids. They've had, you know, that happens a lot. You know, you have low-income kids who go rob a store or get into a fight or something like that. But these were wealthy, affluent kids in Southern California who were involved in criminal activities. What was going on with that? Why was this happening, right? And the movie, it's Hollywood, so they take kind of a psychoanalytic look at it. James Dean's character feels like his father is not strong and masculine enough. Natalie Wood's character feels jealous of her younger brother, feels like she's not getting enough affection. Sal Mineo's character is closeted gay, and his parents are living away, and he's being raised by a housekeeper. And it's they're wealthy kids from Southern California, but they're involved in criminal activities. one point in the movie, the father of the James Dean character says, you know, we've bought you everything you could ever want. We bought you a car. We have a nice house. Why are you becoming a criminal? What is this about? Why are you engaging in these kind of activities? What's interesting, you know, Hollywood took a kind of psychoanalytic, you know, pop psychology look at what was going on. But I think the reason that in 1955 there was a rise in juvenile crime among wealthy people in Southern California was because of what was going on in the world. Sure, the USA at that point had the highest standard of living in the world. People had more material commodities than they'd ever had. But all those houses, all those cars, all those hula hoops, all those 45 records were all dripping in blood. It was the blood of the Korean people being bombed and killed, 4 million killed when they tried to reunify the Korean Peninsula. It was the blood of people in Africa that were facing slaughter and attack when they tried to throw off the chains of colonialism. It was the blood of people in South and Central America who were also facing ugly coups and military dictatorships imposed by the United States. It was the blood of people in the southern United States living under Jim Crow segregation. It was the blood of the Chicano people who were also facing horrendous treatment in their own land after it had been stolen from Mexico. And that ugly reality was hanging over everything going on in the U.S. society at the time. You know, it's funny, I had a racist grandfather in Missouri. I remember one time I was in the house with my racist grandfather, and he was like trying to shut the screen door, and the screen door like popped out and broke. And I remember he said, "God damn it, this house must be built on top of an Indian graveyard." And I was a kid, and I thought, what in the world does that mean? You know, and I found out this was an old racist expression, right? It was a belief that that the ghosts of Native Americans would, like, come into houses and make things break, right? That's an old racist expression. You know, this house must be built on top of an Indian graveyard. It was a racist expression. I'd never heard it, but as a kid, but my grandfather being an older guy who said these kind of things. But if you think about it, the United States, the entire United States is built on top of an Indian graveyard. And it's not just an Indian graveyard. It's an African graveyard. It's a Vietnamese graveyard, right? It's a graveyard of people from the Middle East, a graveyard of people from Latin America, U.S. imperialism. And when we talk about being socialists and revolutionaries, what separates us from those who might be reformists is that we're not looking to just kind of adjust the way things are. We want the country to be completely reborn, right? In the Islamic tradition, I learned when I was in the Middle East that they have a concept called haram, right? And they explain that if you steal some food and you eat it, it might make you sick. Or if you take out a usurious loan to get a house, that house will fall down or catch on fire. That when things are acquired in an impure way, they become corrupted, right? They talk about fruit of a poison tree in legal terms, right? When the origin is corrupt, the result is also corrupt. And that's why, as socialists, we represent a different current in U.S. history. We represent, you know, the current of John Brown, Harriet Tubman, Susan B. Anthony, William Z. Foster, Gus Hall. We represent the revolutionary traditions of struggle, which have always battled against the ugly side of America, of colonialism, racism. We represent a call for refounding the entire country based on new systems of egalitarianism, compassion, human reason, and not greed and brutality. We call for a whole new America to be built based on an entirely new foundation. And it's a long tradition of socialists. And I remember when I was first getting involved in socialist politics, I was a college student in Ohio. And somebody who was in the organization I was in, they were driving from Michigan, and they picked me up from my university in Ohio, and we drove up to Buffalo, New York. And we went to the home of a woman who was well over 80, maybe even 90 years old. And we sat in her living room, and she got out the photo album, and she showed us pictures from the 1950s, from the bad old days. And she told us about her life, about how in 1948 she was living in Buffalo, and the steel mill in Buffalo, belonging to Bethlehem Steel, fired every worker who was a member of the Communist Party USA for being a communist. So she and her fellow activists, they protested outside the steel plant and said that, you know, steel workers have the right to be in whatever political party they want. The Communist Party, the Democratic Party, this is an attack on their civil rights. And across the street from the demonstration was the FBI. And they were taking pictures of everyone who was there. And the next day, in the newspaper, it printed the name and address of every single person at the demonstration. And then she was a high school teacher at the time. And a couple days later, she got called down to the principal's office. She was there at the principal's office. There were two FBI men there with photographs of her at this demonstration. The principal said, "Is this true? You were at a communist rally, a communist demonstration?" She said, "Yes, that's me." And he said, "Well, you're fired. You're not going to be teaching at this school." So a couple months later, she got another job at an elementary school. Everything was going fine. Students, she was doing well with everybody. And one day she got called down to the office. There were the FBI men once again. You know, photographs of her at this rally against the steel company for firing the communist workers. She also lost her job. So then she got a job at a phone company. And she was there for a couple months. The FBI showed up. She got called into the office, the FBI men, and they said, "Is this true? You're a communist? You were at this demonstration?" And they said, she said, "Yes, that's me in the photo." And they said, "Well, you're not going to talk about communism on the phone, are you?" And she said, "No." And they said, "Then we don't care. You're fine." So she kept a job, and that's how she lived. She worked for AT&T, for a phone company, because the phone company didn't care that she was a communist, you know? And that's what these folks had to go through. They went through some real hardship. They talk about, I've also heard older folks talk about how they used to keep all the Marxist books at the public library behind the counter. And if you wanted to check it out, you could. But you'd go to the counter and you'd say, "I'd like to get one of the Marxist books." And they would write down your name. And you'd check it out. And then a couple weeks later, the FBI would come to your house and say, "Why were you checking these books out? Are you involved in any subversive organization? Are you, you know, this was the McCarthy era." People forget how bad it is. People think it was all about Hollywood actors. They forget that it was ordinary people that were being persecuted. And our comrades went through some real hardship during those times. How do you think our comrades were feeling the night the Rosenbergs got executed? How do you think our comrades were feeling when their kids came home from school and said, you know, "Mom, Dad, you know, they had us hide under our desks at school, and they said it's to, you know, it's because the communists are going to send bombs and kill us all." And I got really confused because I thought you guys were communists. I thought you told me that Lenin and Stalin were good. I'm confused. What's going on here? Right? These were hard times. But I think that our comrades probably weren't as demoralized as we would suspect. I think they probably weren't as downtrodden and upset by it as you might think. Because I think they knew pretty well that you never step into the same river twice. That A does not equal A. I kind of wish I could go back in time. You ever wish you could go back in time? I wish I could go back in time, back to that point. I could say to those FBI men, those witch hunters, Joe McCarthy, the House Un-American Activities Committee, "Sure, have your fun. Enjoy yourself. This is your time. Have your fun. But I've got a feeling you're not going to be feeling too good when Joe McCarthy is made into a national disgrace and people realize he's full of lies, he's exposed, and he goes and drinks himself to death in a bar. I bet you're not going to be feeling too good when Martin Luther King starts leading national protests and demonstrations for civil rights, an issue that the Communist Party has been talking about for a long time. I bet you're not going to be feeling too good when students all across the country and universities are burning their draft cards and sending their blood to support the Vietnamese Liberation Front. I bet you're not going to be feeling too good when anti-war rallies are taking place all over the country." You see, what they couldn't understand and what we understand is that the world is constantly in a state of change. You never step into the same river twice, and A does not equal A.
And you can find more of the work of Caleb Maupin at CalebMaupin.com. This is Arts Express, and coming up, also premiering this month at the Slamdance Film Festival in Utah as well, is director Lynn Sachs's documentary tribute to her father, Ira Sachs, likewise a filmmaker, as the opening night feature about a father who, on January 24th. But Sachs also happens to be a poet, and in our poetry corner now, she reads some of her work from her new book, Year by Year Poems. Lynn Sachs explains.
This is Lynn Sachs, and I am talking about my book, Year by Year Poems, for Prairie Miller. So when I turned 50 years old in 2011, I decided that I wanted to write a poem for every year of my life. I'd been writing poetry all of my life, but I hadn't embraced the poetry writing in the sense that it would be so integrated into my life until I just started this project. So I decided that each poem had to integrate something that was part of my interior world or my domestic universe in conjunction with or parallel with something else going on outside my own sphere, some like an event that I couldn't control, a political event or something happening in the weather or something just confronting me in a personal way, an assault of some kind, something that was beyond my grasp. So almost every poem does exactly that. Some of them are more intimate and specific to my personal vision of the world and my own home space or my family. But most of them do try to address this intersection. And so I chose a few poems today to read to you that I thought would be of interest. So each poem is named for a year, and this is 1968. To me, she is a Japanese girl and a 19-year-old woman. Mayumi is living with us this summer, my friend and also my mother's, two in one or split down the middle. I watch her long, smooth black hair, her fingers shape a swan from a sheet of square paper. On my 7th birthday, we all take a ride on Daddy's boat. Hairy men and bikini ladies float on the Mississippi. Marijuana smoke, six packs bobbing in the water, noisy indiscretions. Mayumi folds her birds and lets them fly into the brown, foamy water. Mom tells us that two black garbage men had nowhere to go to hide from the rain, so they took a rest inside a truck in a parking lot and were crushed, like the garbage, just like that. A few days later, all the black garbage men in Memphis decide to stop picking up the trash. They're on a strike, she says. The mayor calls for a 7 o'clock curfew. It's summertime, but everyone has to stay inside. No more catching fireflies and putting them in pickle jars. I think I hear the sound of a gun that shoots King. Close the window. Turn on the AC. Such a noisy machine. I can't hear a thing. Neighborhood teenagers sneak cigarettes in the park, and Mayumi wonders if she's landed in a war zone. Okay, so the next poem is 30 years later. It's 1999, and I'm already a mom, and Columbine happens, meaning the first of what we now know have been many school shootings by teenagers who were students in the school. And so I wrote this poem in response to that memory of that event. 1999. In our front yard now, Columbine grows wild. With each bloom, I think of her, a mother too. She feeds her son, knows the fruit that makes his lips pucker, the sheet that pricks his stubbly cheek, the grade he received on his biology test, how often he hiccups drinking a Coke, which ride scares him at the amusement park, how he conjures an obscure spelling word, the moment in a day when he is most likely to be kind. When he is most likely to be kind. I doubt he ever told her about the night his skin touched skin, or the day he skipped school, or how many guns he hid behind the broken sewing machine table that she refuses to throw away because one day she hopes to have the time to sew again. So I've noticed that anyone who was alive and older than perhaps 5 years old remembers September 11th, 2001. And I wrote a very short poem about that day, which I'll read now. Before my eyes, an unimaginable accident of chance is transformed into something unworthy of a breath. Unable to comprehend the reality of death, my daughters mourn the death of the twins. And then I wrote a poem about the state of mind we were all in 2002. Welcome to the Department of Homeland Insecurity. I'm with my friend in her car, not far from the Pentagon. She's wearing white beauty gloves, the kind I've seen in the pharmacy. They don't offer warmth on a chilly day, so I ask, why are you wearing gloves today? Here you'll find inscrutable dust under your tongue, in your nails, your nose, dust that pushes past security bars and screen doors. Particles are everywhere and nowhere. We each have a hand in both. So this is 2004, and I wrote a poem the first day that my younger daughter rode by herself on the subway. 2004. Your first ride on the subway, alone. The cool air of the train on a hot July afternoon. My whisper deposits secrets inside your ear. Mass transit lullabies. I let go of your small hand. You step across alligator pits, circus tightropes, the orange glow of the F train. Explosions in the Madrid metro send shards of anxiety across the Atlantic. My jaw tightens. Might you be safer if we still used tokens, out-of-date amulets of the 20th century? And then the last one that I'll read today is 2010, which is essentially my healthcare bill poem. 2010. In the eventuality that preparation for security advanced, signatures obtained, life jackets confirmed, permanent medical records sealed, pharmaceuticals delivered, weather reported, batteries checked, tires filled, expiration avoided, warnings acknowledged, wills signed, if and only ifs collected, and still no one anticipated the return of my brother-in-law's cancer. A friend forgot to send her payment, a single check she never put in the envelope, hidden under a stack of worthless receipts, appointment cards, and electricity bills. The check never arrived, her policy canceled. She, who had already given up her ovaries and come face to face in the ring with illness, won that round. Now, no rope to hold on to, no pillows to fall back on. We two friends of more than 20 years sit at a table in a cafe talking of our homes, books we've read. People almost forgotten, purses with zippers, jump ropes, kitchen counters, projects abandoned. I ask her about her health. She's crossing her fingers. That's all she has until they pass that bill. So those are a selection from my 50 poems. And the book is called Year by Year Poems. It's published by Tender Buttons Press and available from Small Press Distribution as well as Amazon. And my name is Lynn Sachs.
And now we'll hear Lynn's short film, The Washing Society, spotlighting the invisible laundromat workers who, quote, fold the clothes, maintain the machines, and know your secrets. And what is the Washing Society and their Atlanta strike and uprising back in 1881?
On a normal day, on a normal 9-hour day, I do myself no less than 25 to 26 bags. I think that I fold over 1,000 pieces of clothes a day. And you know, just little articles, socks, you know, underwear. All of them have to be turned inside out one by one. Every piece counts.
I think about other things when I'm doing it. My mind wanders.
All you get is their name and their bag of dirty stuff. You write it on a tag. A tag for all that sweat, coffee, period stains, and whatever.
Atlanta, July 1881. 20 African-American laundresses meet to form the Washing Society. They demand respect and control over their work. They go door to door asking other laundresses across the city to join their strike. In 3 weeks, the Washing Society grows from 20 to 3,000 strikers.
Sí, él es dueño de muchos lugares.
Tengo muchos sueños.
Pero yo no digo nada.
Me lo reservo para mí.
Pero yo no digo nada. Me lo reservo para mí.
Nos dejan quietas la mayoría del tiempo.
Sí, yo estoy muy bien.
Mientras hagamos nuestro trabajo, nos dejan quietas.
¿Qué vas a hacer? Documentary.
And for more information about her many films, screenings, and her poetry readings, you can visit lynnsax.com. And we'll go out now with Bro on the Global Television Beat, Trends and What to Watch or Not, or rather, Watching or Being Watched. The goal not stated of these movie conglomerates moving online is to use serial TV as a way to harvest data on users to sell the data to advertisers, allowing the entertainment complexes to become full-fledged members of the surveillance economy.
500 shows and almost nothing to watch. Top 10 TV series. This is Bro on the Global Television Beat, Breaking Glass, with my top 10 series, which this year has morphed into a top 15, with 15 honorable mentions, as well as my 5 worst series. I could not fit all the series I like into a top 10, so I have what amounts to a top 30 best series in global television. At first glance, this might indicate that series are improving, but let's not be so hasty. In the U.S. alone, not even to mention worldwide, there were just under 500 series produced in 2019 on network, cable, and streaming services, so the fact that there are a rising number of watchable and even quality series is more a factor of the number of series as a whole increasing. We've gone from what used to be called the second golden age of television, which in truth may have finished around 2004, with the period's ending marked by the demise of the HBO series Deadwood, to what is now referred to as peak TV. The name denotes a phenomenon where the market, as happened with oil, is glutted, and one has to dig down much deeper to refine or find a watchable series. Yes, there are more quality series, but there are also more mediocre series, with the vast majority being simply unwatchable, just niche series with a very limited appeal or prepackaged ripoffs of previous series or movies. In the supposedly quality era of streaming TV, we are actually getting closer to the phenomenon of cable, that is 500 channels, or in this case series, with almost nothing to watch. That's the first major trend, saturation or peak TV. The second, of course, is the rise of the streaming services, with Netflix and Amazon now joined by Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus, and with NBC Universal titled Peacock and AT&T Time Warner titled HBO Max still to come. A wave of consolidation accompanied these behemoths, with Disney buying Fox, AT&T absorbing Time Warner, CBS merging with Paramount Viacom, and finally Comcast, one of the largest cable companies in the U.S., also now owning NBC, and buying Europe's leading satellite company, Sky. The goal in many of these mergers is to create original series and lock up movie studio back catalogs so that the service provides a seemingly endless array of product. The other goal, not stated, of these conglomerates moving online is to use serial TV as a way to harvest data on users and sell the data to advertisers so that advertisers are paying not only to advertise on the streaming service, but also for data collected by the service. Hence, AT&T, the conservative company from Dallas, on merging with Time Warner, bought a company that allows it to send targeted ads to all devices, and Disney Plus, contracted Publicis, a company which is already adept at collecting data from TV sets and selling it without the viewer's consent. So, the movement now allows these entertainment complexes to become full-fledged members of the surveillance economy and converts the freedom of serial TV into a device for moment-by-moment first creating and manipulating and then spying on and harvesting consumer interest. A word about my particular bent in terms of series TV and in general. Manny Farber, way back in the early 60s, wrote a crucial essay on the difference between elephant and termite art. Elephant art being big-budget, meaningful art with a socially uplifting purpose, and termite art being low-budget, degraded, prickly art with no apparent redeeming social value. He might as well have been saying bourgeois art, which caters to an upper-middle-class taste, versus working-class art enjoyed by the masses and discounted by the critics. I'm almost always on the side of termite art. On TV, this would be the Nancy Drews, Burden of Truth, In the Dark, rather than the elephant art of Secession, The Morning Show, and Billions or Black Monday. The other trend is that this year saw the first wave of post-Me Too series come down the serial pipeline, and the prognostication is positive. Female leads in Stumptown, In the Dark, Proven Innocent, Burden of Truth, and Nancy Drew generally were part of a formula that produced series that were nicer, less violent, and more social or directly political than previous series with male leads. This was apparent, for example, in the difference in two series on Apple TV+, the more patriarchal, typically apocryphal Mad Max-like C, and the more matriarchal, looser, and more quietly questioning the persistence of the colonial social order of Dickinson. I should add, also vis-a-vis my top series, that a successful series is one that gets on the air, not necessarily one that has a long run, since so many of the best series are canceled quickly, with cancellation in a commercial medium generally having little to do with the quality of the series. And here's my top 15 TV series. Homecoming. Much more than a Julia Roberts vehicle, this Amazon Prime series originated as a podcast, which made for an extremely tightly constructed half hour, the equivalent plot-wise of most hour series. Roberts, slowly coming to grips with a corporate-induced amnesia, shed light on, and was one of the few series to tackle, the nefariousness of Big Pharma as the opioid crisis persists. Bad Banks. Season 1 of this German-Luxembourg series, now airing on Hulu, with Season 2 soon to come, boasted one of the most outstanding pilots, beginning with a run on a bank and flashing back to the financial crimes that led to that collapse, including millennial bankers cheering wildly at a California earthquake, which resulted in their profiting from a financial instrument that pays off on catastrophes. Bob Hart's Abishola. Much better Chuck Lorre series than the elephant-like The Kaminsky Method. This touching on-again, off-again courtship and romance, solidly rooted in the day-to-day conflicts of its female Nigerian hospital nurse and male Detroit small business owner, has its share of embarrassing stock sitcom characters, Abishola's aunt and uncle, Bob's sister and brother, but the leads, and especially Folake Olowofuyeku's Abishola, aided by the writing of Jeannie Ashere, make this an extremely heartwarming series. Bloody Vienna, BBC Two mystery series, likely soon to circulate on BBC America, that maps the reactionary anti-Semitism and stifling militarism of post-Wendesiecle Vienna, as well as its grappling toward modernity in its secessionist art at the dawning of psychoanalysis. Both are embodied in the young Freudian Max Liebermann, who aids a working-class Austrian detective by employing this new science of the mind to solve crimes that originate in the repressed atmosphere of the upper reaches of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Who is America? Sacha Baron Cohen's one-season wonder on Showtime, in which he inhabits four characters in candid camera-like situations, but that, unlike that series, rather than simply the frivolous, exposes the innate racist and violent nature of the actual American personalities he catches being themselves. Best character is Israeli officer Colonel Eran Morad, whose own militarist impulses allow those of the southern old boy subjects he encourages to emerge on screen. Jeu d'influence, or Game of Influence, now broadcasting on Amazon Prime, this French series lays bare the disastrous effects of lobbyists who, in this case, are aiming to keep a cancerous agricultural product based on Monsanto's glyphosate on the market. Well-told, Zola-esque view of the industry, its farmer victims, and the politicians of all the legislative parties who, knowing the product is murderous, delay till yet another session banning it, just as, in fact, Macron's government has done with the actual product. Proven Innocent, Fox The network where all good series go to die broadcast 13 episodes, then canceled the show about a female attorney who fights to free unlawfully jailed victims of the Chicago criminal justice system, and in so doing exposes the inequities of that system. This is the antidote to the more conservative procedural Cold Case, since here the back case is about proving the defendant innocent. A marvelous, complete-in-itself 13-episode arc also ties the original murder for which Rachel Lefevre's attorney was imprisoned back to Kelsey Grammer's prosecutor, now running for attorney general, who persecutes her, with the show linking the actual guilt to the post-Citizens United world where unlimited money furthers unjust candidates. Folklore. HBO Asia series based on the fact that, as its creator, Singapore director Eric Koo says, everyone in Asia believes in ghosts. But the catch in this marvelous horror anthology from six Asian countries is that, unlike Jordan Peele's Twilight Zone, which took a while to become relevant, this series right off the bat combines ghost stories with the actual horror of ordinary people's lives on a continent where the disparity between rich and poor is vast. Back to Life. Airing on Showtime, this is the second stunning and funny series from alumni of the too-soon-departed satire of the television industry Episodes. Following Stephen Mangan's Hang Ups, Daisy Haggard's series about a woman sent to prison for murder returning to a town that rejects her is a bittersweet version of Rectify. But here the humor and the pathos is more direct, as Haggard proves herself first a marvelous comedian and then a marvelous actress. Grease. Another HBO Asia series, this one condensing 200 years of rebellion against the Dutch in a province of Indonesia into a single uprising that employs the iconography and attitudes of a Sergio Leone Western to make its point about Dutch colonial brutality amid native resistance and compliance. This is Bro on the Global Television Beat, signing off with the best and worst of serial TV. You can find more on the ins and outs of contemporary television in my book, Birth of the Binge.
And Bro's discussion on the topic will continue on the next show. And we'll go out now on Arts Express with the Paris Opera on strike in a jubilant free outdoor concert of resistance on strike with the French masses. And this is Prairie Miller on the Arts Express leaving the station.
Staying healthy and avoiding things in the environment that can be harmful to you and your family, the world can be a confusing place. Hi, I'm Patty Wood from Green Street, and every Tuesday morning, Doug and I will sort it out for you, calling out the bad actors, bringing you insightful interviews with experts, and sharing our own views on the issues of the day. So tune in to Green Street every Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock, right here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and streaming around the world at WBAI.org.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, hammer in the evening.
Folk Radio, a weekly eclectic folk music program with rotating hosts, debuts this Tuesday, January 14th, from 10 p.m. to midnight, and will continue each Tuesday evening from then on. Tune in. Each week will be different, right here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City or at WBAI.org.
Accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
Amended and restated Pacifica bylaws amendments have been proposed and may now be found on the Foundation's website at www.pacifica.org for review and have been voted on by the Pacifica National Board and are to be voted on by the station delegates, followed by a membership vote.
Pacifica Radio has been compelled under California court order to consider amendments to its bylaws. Now, these bylaws protect the democratic governance system, key to our mission of promoting peace and justice through our broadcasts. The court order was initiated by Pacifica National Board members Donald Goldmacher from KPFA, Mansour Sabag from KPFK, and Bill Crozier from KPFT. Crozier was one of the board members who came and closed down WBAI on October 7th. However, in the opinion of a large majority of the Pacifica National Board, the proposed bylaws amendments are destructive, a slap in the face at all the activists who struggled for years to create a democratic governance structure for Pacifica. It would do away with our local station boards and replace them with rubber stamp advisory boards that now dominate NPR stations. It would put Pacifica under the absolute control of six transitional directors appointed by those who filed the lawsuit. They would even have final say over all Pacifica broadcasts, including over WBAI. I'm Alex Steinberg, pro tem chair of the Pacifica National Board and member of WBAI's local station board. I urge all delegates and members to study these bylaws carefully and vote your conscience. This is WBAI New York.
You're listening to 99.5 FM. WBAI New York.
Not commercial, listener sponsor.
Peace and Justice Radio.
Now stay tuned for Equal Time for Free Thought.
Welcome back to Equal Time for Free Thought.
On Equal Time for Free Thought, we explore a non-religious worldview based on scientific naturalism and secular humanism, and how this worldview can help us become a more equitable, socially just, and peaceful